Prentice. For those of you who don't know me, I'm presenting this series of Global Health History seminars in conjunction with the Wellcome Trust Centre for the History of Medicine in London. And I'm very pleased again to have Sanjoy Bhattacharya here on behalf of the Wellcome Trust. This is about halfway through the series now. We're down to here, and you're going to enjoy this one so much that you'll come to the following four before Christmas. Today I'm going to introduce you in a second to Professor Daniel Pick, thanks for coming, Daniel. He's from the Professor at the School of History, Classics and Archaeology at Birkbeck College, University, London. And his track record is quite astonishing. His interests are in the field of European culture, thought, and human sciences, particularly in England, France, and Italy. He's written on many aspects of the history of psychoanalysis, psychology, and psychiatry, the historiography of war, of trauma, and group conflict, to subjects as exotic as cultural attitudes to the Victorian city, to crime, madness, and sexuality, the politics of Darwinism, degeneration theory, the ideology of nationalism. He's published a number of books. I think the most recent, tell me if I'm wrong, but the most recent is Rome or Death.
That's right.
Rome or Death, The Obsessions of General Garibaldi. Has that got you interested a little bit? Daniel, it's up to you. He's going to speak from notes, I think. We're going to tape record this. Thanks very much to Carol Modis, who's our supremo of the oral history side of this kind of work. Thanks again, Carol, for being here. So when we get to questions, remember that you will be taped, but you know that's nothing is going to be held against you. But it might help if you put your name before your question. And we'll hope for a nice discussion. And without further ado,
just one question: is you're not going to be using slides?
No.
Then I'll turn these lights on.
Okay. Shall I turn this off?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Just tell me when you've got the lights to your satisfaction.
How do you spell Nick? The name of the speaker. How do you spell it?
How do you spell my surname?
Yeah.
P-I-C-K.
Come again?
P-I-C-K.
Oh, like the pickaxe, okay.
Further questions maybe after the speech?
No, that's important.
Is that how you want the legs? Is that okay for
you? Yeah, we'd like to see you.
Is that it?
Okay. And do you want me to actually speak into the microphone, or can I just... You're going to pick me up anyway.
Okay. Daniel, it's up to you.
Thank you very much. Well, I'm delighted to be here, and thank you very much to you both for the invitation. Actually, I was just handed by Thompson as I came into the building today the WHO World Health Report 2001, and I was pleased to see right at the beginning on page 3 the statement, "The importance of mental health has been recognised by WHO since its origin and is reflected by the definition of health in the WHO Constitution as, quote, not merely the absence of disease or infirmity, but rather a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being," which I think resonates very well with what I'm going to talk about today, which is really about mental health and fascism in the 1940s. Writing soon after the war, Brock Chisholm, the first Director General of WHO, alluded to the recent epoch of fascism and militarism and the need for what he saw as a kind of international healing from the collective catastrophe of war, when he observed that, quote, "the world was sick and the ills from which it was suffering were mainly due to the perversion of man, his inability to live at peace with himself." Now, a few years earlier, in an essay of 1941, entitled Wells, Hitler and the World State, George Orwell, soon to be the famous author of Animal Farm and 1984, observed that certain writers, and here he had his sights on H.G. Wells, had failed hitherto to grasp the particular nature of Hitler's menace and the intertwined psychological and technological aspects of his evil. Attempts, wrote Orwell, to ridicule Hitler in Charlie Chaplin fashion as, quote, "the screaming little defective in Berlin," would not do. Orwell wrote, quote again, "Hitler is a criminal lunatic, and Hitler has an army of millions of men, aeroplanes in thousands, tanks in tens of thousands. Before you can even talk of world reconstruction or even peace, you have got to eliminate Hitler, which means bringing into being a dynamic not necessarily the same as that of the Nazis, but probably quite as unacceptable to enlightened and hedonistic people. End of quote. Now, Orwell intimated here that polite, democratic, or liberal ideals might not help us get to the heart of fascist darkness, or even help us to mobilise effectively against it. And he went on to write, and I quote again, "The people who say that Hitler is Antichrist, or alternatively the Holy Ghost, are nearer an understanding of the truth than the intellectuals who for 10 dreadful years have kept it up that he is merely a figure out of comic opera, not worth taking seriously. All that this idea really reflects is the sheltered conditions of English life. Those who knew of Hitler firsthand, he thought, were less likely to make this mistake. Quote again, "Only in the English-speaking countries was it fashionable to believe, right up to the outbreak of war, that Hitler was an unimportant lunatic and the German tanks made of cardboard." Quote again, "The people who have shown the best understanding of fascism are either those who have suffered under it or those who have a fascist streak in themselves." This lecture is not about Orwell, still less about Chisholm, or about WHO, but I hope in discussion, I'm reintroducing a research project that I've just got going on recently, so I'm hoping that we could have a genuine discussion afterwards about how the history that I'm going to sketch might relate to WHO and its own very rich history and archives. But I want to suggest that in the 1940s, it was indeed a commonplace during and after the Allied struggle against fascism. It became a commonplace to argue that because the world was, in Chisholm's words, ill and perverse, psychiatrists, psychologists, and psychoanalysts might be required alongside, or sometimes within governments and international organisations, to make, as it were, a diagnosis and to propose a remedy. In short, it was often argued in this period that the kind of expertise that would be required to treat this so-called collective sickness could not be supplied by statesmen or economic planners acting alone, but required some input from those who specialised in exploring the vices and vicissitudes of psychic life. To put it another way round, I'm suggesting that around the Second World War, it became a cultural commonplace to argue that to study politics necessarily entailed exploring, above all else, human irrationality in all its guises, and that specialised knowledge might be required to do so. This did not necessarily mean, although sometimes it did, but it didn't necessarily mean denying the existence of other forces, the underlying structural socioeconomic processes that shape people in the first place, but it did mean, for many of the commentators that I'm working on, an insistence that human minds, and perhaps above all the unconscious aspects of minds, or of minds in interaction with one another, had to be of central significance in any adequate understanding of what had happened. Now, I quoted those examples from Orwell and Chisholm at the outset by way of introducing my main concern in this talk, namely to show how medico-psychiatric and also psychoanalytic designations of this collective, quote, sickness, became linked in complex ways to the experience and the interpretation of the Third Reich. And so I want to comment today on some of the projects that did, in this period, seek to turn, as it were, a psychiatric eye, or even perhaps a psychoanalytic ear, upon the problem of fascism. And I'll give a concrete example later on in the talk, where these kinds of understanding were brought together. And this was in the now forgotten case of the psychiatric and psychotherapeutic treatment of Rudolf Hess, the deputy Führer of the Nazi Party, after he unexpectedly became a prisoner stroke patient of the British in 1941. Now, whether we agree with Orwell's claim that liberal democracy might be ill-equipped to understand fascism, his insistence on taking very seriously the madness of Hitler and endeavouring to analyse the allegiance of the millions who followed him has remained in many ways a central plank in the interpretation of Nazism. Never in history, observes the historian, the great historian of the Third Reich, Ian Kershaw, never in history, he writes in his remarkable biography of Hitler, has such physical and moral ruination been so associated with the name of a single man. That Nazism and the catastrophe that it wrought had far deeper causes than the aims and actions of an individual is, of course, evident. The depths of inhumanity plumbed by the Third Reich relied upon thought and belief that had crystallised over half a century or more. It emerged from a particular conjuncture of socio-economic, political, cultural and ideological circumstances after 1918, and its barbaric practices, especially and increasingly after 1933, drew upon wide-ranging complicity at all levels of society. Yet however significant the responsibility and culpability of others was, Hitler is justifiably identified as the principal instigator of the most extraordinary disintegration of everything that has stood for civilization in modern times. Now, that the vision of Hitler's profound madness, the malignant, sadistic, paranoiac, perverse, depraved, demonic aspects of his mind, call them what you will, but all of those designations, that vision of Hitler and his mind, became a prominent feature of post-war Western culture at large. But it had already been signalled much earlier in anti-fascist writings and warnings that had emerged in the 1920s and beyond. And it even started to emerge in Anglo-American political communications about Germany in the late 1930s, when lingering beliefs in the possibility of ordinary diplomacy based on rational calculations ran aground and had to be given up finally. If there were indeed very many people, both inside and outside Germany, who had at best turned a blind eye to Hitler's noxious plans and powerful appeal, there were some who had presciently foreseen the malign psychosocial consequences of what was called Hitlerism, and they sought to offer warnings in which the language of evil and of pathology both figured prominently. Interestingly, from my point of view, since it is the psychiatric, psychological, and psychoanalytical aspects that were given to this anti-Nazi discourse that I focus upon here, a doctor had written a report on Hitler's mental state as early as 1924, whilst he was in prison after the failed Munich putsch. That is to say, long before the better-known Second World War period psychiatric and psychoanalytic studies of Hitler's mind. It's anecdotally interesting, I think, in this regard, to note that the 1924 report on Hitler's case would be unearthed and used again in a later study that was commissioned by the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, forerunner of the CIA, in the US in 1941, the same year, coincidentally, as my Hess study, to which I'll return later, when the OSS commissioned its own study of the mind of Hitler through a Freudian lens. And these were forerunners of the kinds of psychological profiling of leaders that did indeed become a commonplace of the CIA and other intelligence organisations in the post-war world. But a mix of moral condemnation and quasi-forensic diagnosis also entered into wider cultural thought about Hitler well before the disaster unfolded. Germany's leading liberal daily paper, the Frankfurter Zeitung, looking on critically and mockingly at Hitler's rise in 1928, wrote, quote, "Hitler has a demon in him." The article went on, "It is a matter of a manic idea of atavistic origin that pushes aside complicated reality and replaces it with a primitive unit." But despite many other speculative inquiries and thought experiments, and even during the Second World War, a kind of spoof clinical diagnosis that appeared in New York, again in 1941, by a so-called Dr. Kröger, who claimed to be the Führer's psychotherapist through the years before the war, Hitler was in fact always analysed or psychoanalysed from a distance. He was not actually a patient. It was always, in Freud's term, wild analysis, armchair speculation about a patient who wasn't on the couch. It's true that the wartime psychoanalytic, or for that matter, philosophical, anthropological and sociological explorations of fascism of the type that I'm highlighting here from the 1940s and 50s have more recently receded from view, and they're not perhaps now part of the mainstream way we think about this topic. For in the longer run, after the war, it was theories of totalitarianism that put theories of fascism rather into the shade. The task of denazification, which was a hot topic in around sort of 1945, 1946, quickly gave way to other priorities as the Cold War took effect. In totalitarian theories in the 1950s and beyond, fascism and communism were twinned together as dual evils, and a rather different set of debates and metaphors emerged. But here, to repeat, I want to focus on that earlier moment and the narrower question of how clinical studies of and theories about fascism emerged to prominence. And I want to ask how far these influenced and were influenced by prevailing theories of the mind in this period. I think there'll be lots of interesting questions to put to all of you, those of you who, if there are people here who work in sort of mental health policy today, but about that same question, about how much theories of mental health shape politics and how far current politics shapes the way one thinks about the mind. But let me at this point offer a tentative periodization of this whole subject. I would suggest that in modern history there have been several different phases in thinking about politics in this kind of psychologistic way. All of these phases have been contested and controversial, but I just want to sketch them out very briefly. If we rewind the tape back before all of this and rewind to the 19th century, we can already identify there a variety of theories in which political extremism had come to be regarded as forms of mental or physical pathology. Medical metaphors and analogies often held pride of place in the 19th century. And I'm not going to dwell today on that earlier context, which I've written about elsewhere in a book called Faces of Degeneration. But I just want to sort of suggest that particularly after 1850, there was indeed a new psychiatric interest in political extremism. But even before that, even before the psychiatrists got a bit busy with what we now call by the shorthand term of degenerationism, a variety of hostile critics ruminating on the French Revolution had diagnosed mass behaviour as a kind of volcanic eruption of madness and anarchy. Not so much a clash of beliefs or ideologies or of one class or social order at war with another, but rather, so it was held by certain influential commentators, symptoms of mental or spiritual distress. Now, the most influential exponent of that view was the Victorian sage Thomas Carlyle. In his essay called Chartism in the late 1830s, dealing with English working class protesters, Carlyle insisted that the real message of these protesters, these working class people seeking the vote, was not, as it were, the thing they believed it was. He believed that beneath their, quote, inarticulate dumb cry, they were really saying, quote, I am mad and miserable, govern me. Later, after the Paris Commune, when France again erupted into revolution and the Paris Commune led to barricades on the streets of Paris in 1871, conservative writers, anti-revolutionary writers, such as the French historian and psychologist Hippolyte Taine, still more explicitly linked such views to medical discourse, describing the communards as so many pathological, psychiatric and criminal cases, nothing but a bunch of alcoholics, prostitutes and habitual criminals. History and politics here was to be understood primarily as a form of pathology. And the historian, said Taine, must be versed in the latest clinical work to be up to date. And indeed, a series of studies were produced in the last decades of the 19th century detailing the hereditary background and the general degeneracy of the participants of such revolutionary upheavals. Their conscious views were not the thing that was important. It was rather their underlying pathology that was called into question. And there are many variants of this kind of belief in this sort of theory. And the novelist Emile Zola wrote 20 novels all about the sort of underlying hereditary degeneracy of people in France. And I've mentioned Taine. Another example would be the Italian criminologist Lombroso, who spent some of his career studying anarchists in late 19th century Italy, very much in these terms, understanding anarchist activists as simply a manifestation of a kind of atavism, of a they were born criminals in his terms. And indeed their body, he thought, actually gave away their nature, that you could read the signs of their mental pathology in their physical appearance. But if this 19th century evolutionist and degenerationist background forms one starting point for any study of how we have come to psychologize and medicalize politics in the 20th century, another very different starting point lies in the decades immediately before and after the First World War, when a new set of ideas, in many ways at odds with those earlier orthodoxies, came to hold significant influence. And I'm thinking here of Sigmund Freud, whose work came to prominence after 1900. Now again, his ideas were always contested. There were other psychologies available in the early 20th century, not least the psychology of Carl Jung, with whom Freud broke before the First World War. So there are other variants, but I want to focus on Freud and his followers because they played a very significant role in defining a new kind of exploration of the pathologies within, or perhaps simply the pathologies of, politics. And between 1920 and 1950, psychoanalysis explored, amongst many other things, the fascist mind. And it seems to me that the psychoanalytic inquiry that emerged into fascism was in many ways more disturbing than those earlier Victorian theories I sketched out earlier. Because, in a nutshell, one of the things that was seen to be so disturbing about this was the idea that all minds, not just, as it were, deviant minds, might have a fascist potential, that these might simply be aspects of normal psychology, rather than that one might hive off a separate class or category called the degenerate. Now, with Freud had come a new set of ideas and a new theoretical language, indebted to various earlier thinkers, including Charles Darwin, to be sure, but in many ways inaugurating a novel development and quite new trajectory of thought and clinical practice and method of inquiry. Although again for Freud, political allegiances were often seen to be symptomatic of deeper, as it were, psychological rather than biomedical causes, of which we are normally consciously quite unaware. And this theory lent itself to the subsequent exploration of fascist political desires. Freud suggested that we should understand political attachments then not in terms of rational ideas or warring interest, but rather in terms of our more infantile and sometimes unconscious wishes and fears, as well as our search for love and our passionate hatreds and destructiveness. And he likened, and I'm thinking here of an extraordinary paper that he wrote in 1921 called Group Psychology and the Analysis of the Ego, which were there more time I would sketch out in more detail. But here he likened the state of falling in love, religious conversion and hypnosis to the way we function as political animals. So it was a very interesting moment, that text. After the First World War was another kind of key episode for psychoanalysis because of shell shock and the trauma of the trenches and so forth. But it's just in the aftermath of the war, in a way almost uncannily anticipating the age of mass fascist rallies, that Freud wrote this paper, Group Psychology. It's true that I'm fast-forwarding because there's much more one could say about this. But it's true that until an astonishingly late date, Freud continued to hope that psychoanalysis might continue to exist in Germany all the way through the 30s, and really till a very late date. And he continued to hope that, despite the persecution of Jewish psychoanalysts from 1933 onwards and the diaspora of Jewish analysts from Germany and Austria, and despite the burning of Freud's own books in Berlin, right at the beginning of the Third Reich, despite that, Freud hoped that some kind of remnant of psychoanalysis might go on to exist. But that's another whole story. I can tell you about that in discussion, what actually happens in Nazi Germany. But the point I want to make is that increasingly, fascism itself comes to be understood as a pathology that might require an investigation of the unconscious. It's an extraordinary fact that the period from Mussolini's march on Rome in 1922 through Hitler's ascent to become German Chancellor in 1933 also saw the development of a whole new phase of psychoanalytic thought and discussion, kind of second phase after the initial work of the early 1900s, in which Freud and his key followers, including the very influential follower Melanie Klein, as well as others, this group of psychoanalysts developed a range of theories, like the aforementioned ideas about group psychology, but also an array of concepts such as the death drive, ideas about the superego, ideas about repetition, ideas about sadism and destructiveness, which had a very different accent to Freud's early work before the First World War. And these new views of the 1920s came to be used in an attempt to get to the heart of the attraction of the Duce or the Führer in the minds of the masses. And this came to be explored in a variety of ways in the work of clinicians in the interwar years. I think what's interesting though is in starting to uncover this material from the period is really just how diverse this work was. And I think today historians don't tend to read that literature. They tend to assume they know what it was, and they tend to dismiss it very quickly because of its indeed methodological shortcomings, but it's rarely read. Yet in that period, statesmen, historians, journalists, many commentators on fascism came to realize that straightforward socioeconomic analysis alone wouldn't do. It wasn't seen to be sufficient. Even Marxist intellectuals, such as the group that came to be known as the Frankfurt School, who were very committed to understanding fascism, felt they needed the ideas of Freud to add another dimension, because something was at stake in what was going on in Germany that couldn't be explained in any ordinary psychology based on the idea of rational interests, reasons, appetites, and so on. Something else, it seemed, was at stake. Now, just proceeding with my brief sketch of the periodization, there's a further phase of psychoanalytic thought on fascism during the Second World War itself. At this point, especially in the US, there was a more orchestrated attempt to use psychoanalytic ideas as an instrument of intelligence in the war effort. The British too, and this despite the more marginal position that psychoanalysis in particular has always occupied in British culture compared with American, and despite Churchill's own known contempt for psychiatrists at large, nonetheless, these new ideas also got some toehold. And that's partly to do with the case of Hess, which I'll come to in a minute. But I want to just keep on with the sketch of the sort of Cook's tour of the whole field at large, because again, there's a further phase, I think, immediately after the Second World War, 1945 to around 1950, when psychoanalysis and as well as other kinds of psychology and psychiatry are mobilised in thinking about the transition to post-war society and recovery in Germany and elsewhere, including Japan, but most notably with Germany, in which ideas about trauma, shame, guilt, and about the enduring attractions of fascism, even after the war, are taken very seriously as a key to thinking about how to denazify societies. In other words, the exploration of the psychopathology of fascism remains, I think, a major issue. Some commentators on this took the sort of the easy view that there was just something about Germany that made it entirely a case apart. And that ran back into a sort of earlier tradition, again, that one can run back into the 19th century, of some idea of the sort of Germans' ethnic peculiarity that made them more militaristic. But many other commentators in this period were more troubled and thought, well, it happened in Germany and there were specific factors, but that you couldn't rule out that this sort of tendency could happen elsewhere. And I found in doing the work on this project a fascinating archive materials at UNESCO and in various sort of medical libraries here and in the States on the denazification projects through the Allied Control Commission in Germany, where there was really a component of thinking, kind of experimental use of psychoanalysis in trying to weed out Nazis, for instance, from the post-war civil service, using a kind of applied version of Freud's talking cure. But I think it's sort of in a way signalled by a major conference organised at Columbia University in New York in 1944 that was organised, tellingly, by a psychiatrist who'd written, a guy called Richard Brickner, who'd written a book called Is Germany Curable? In which he gathered together psychoanalysts, anthropologists, amongst whom Margaret Mead, and sociologists, including Talcott Parsons, to try to get all these kind of social scientists and psychologists and psychiatrists and psychoanalysts together to think about how you would avoid the resurgence of fascism after the war. And of course, no one knew how the story was going to pan out, that you know, eventually turned out not to be seen as the key problem. But in 1945 and around then, it certainly was. And the role of UNESCO in the late 40s is very interesting in this regard, and I've looked into some of their projects, which again sought to mobilise this kind of interdisciplinary thinking. And the kind of people that UNESCO consulted as part of their project on reducing international tensions included the psychoanalyst and Frankfurt School intellectual Erich Fromm, the emigre psychoanalyst Erik Erikson, the aforementioned Melanie Klein, as well as Anna Freud, Freud's daughter. Their delegation came to London from Paris to consult her, alongside anthropologists like Claude Lévi-Strauss and sociologists like Raymond Aron. And it's a kind of indication of the urgency and the nature of the thinking. And this kind of work culminated, I think, in the famous study of 1950 by Adorno, called The Authoritarian Personality, that became a kind of talking point of 1950. There's again, I think, a still further phase in the 1960s after the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem, about which Hannah Arendt wrote a famous book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, in which there's a kind of rediscovery of these earlier concerns with fascism, the concentration camps, and so forth, and a whole spate of new studies of Nazi psychopathology. For instance, there was a project in England led by the medieval historian Norman Cohen, which gathered together intellectuals to return to the problem of fascism and genocide and war. And this work included a book by a psychotherapist from the Tavistock Clinic called Henry Dix, who I'm going to return to in a moment, about Rudolf Hess. And he went round German prisons interviewing a number of the mass murderers who were still in jail from the Einsatzgruppen and other groups who had been involved in atrocities during the war. And he produced a study published in 1972 called Licensed Mass Murder, which was a kind of further phase of this literature. And interestingly, at that very same moment, I mentioned this wartime study by the OSS, where they commissioned a psychoanalyst. It remained a classified document until the 1970s, and when it was released and became a best-selling book called The Mind of Adolf Hitler by Walter Langer, this Boston psychoanalyst, who's an interesting character in his own right. He was actually on the train with Freud getting out of Vienna in 1938, but that's another story. Let me now, in the remaining part of the talk, turn to a more specific case. And this is the case that I've already flagged, the case of Hitler's deputy, Rudolf Hess. Because here we have the history of an analysis of a fascist subordinate and of his relationship to the leader, to Hitler, that wasn't simply, as it were, psychoanalysis from afar, but was a direct clinical study, albeit of a very odd kind. Hess unexpectedly dropped out of the sky above Scotland in a parachute in 1941 to become a prisoner of the British authorities, but also the basis of a psychiatric case in which political extremism and psychopathology were linked together. But even before he fell into the hands of the British Army and its doctors, Hess was already well known as a loyal and fanatical camp follower of Hitler, the most loyal of the loyal. If anyone's ever seen Leni Riefenstahl's notorious film, The Triumph of the Will, the Nazi propaganda film, you may remember in it there's a sequence in which Hess is there as the kind of warm-up man to Hitler, and it's a fascinating bit of that film. Now, interestingly, Hess himself, actually, even before he takes flight for Britain, had been the object of much gossip and speculation. He was an eccentric and odd character, and speculation about his mental state had also existed before the war. Rumours about his sexuality, or lack of it, his hypochondria, his preoccupation with fringe doctors and occult ideas were rife in Germany even before his flight. But all of that kind of gossip, as it were, got grafted onto a new set of psychological studies in the 40s when he became a prisoner. Now, both sides in the war came to have an interest in regarding Hess as a kind of psychiatric case. In Germany, he was quickly written off as a madman for having fled, and it became the sort of the line that was put out by the German radio very soon after that he'd gone mad. Eventually, for legal purposes, Hess was to be declared sane and fit to stand trial at Nuremberg. But in many ways, in the interim, between 1941 and the post-war war crimes trials, Hess became the kind of object of psychiatric exploration. Hess, of course, saw it a different way. He thought he was remaining loyal to Hitler, even having fled, and that he was, as it were, pursuing Germany's interest, and in fact Hitler's interest, in avoiding a war on two fronts. This was just on the eve of Hitler's Russian campaign. After his flight, moral questions and legal considerations certainly lurked in the background, but the clinicians who were assigned to care for Hess also sought out something else, and it became a very interesting study. They weren't just looking, as it were, to pump the prisoner for diplomatic or military information, or even for forensic information for a post-war trial, but, as it were, in a pursuit of psychiatric evidence about the mind. Now, the language of the reports that were written on Hess are a very interesting mix of the various different currents of thought that I sketched out earlier. In some parts of the report, for instance, you hear something that sounds more like the 19th century stuff, where they were interested in his, quote, degeneracy, atavism, hereditary taint, neurasthenia, hysteria, hypochondria, and paranoia. But at the same time, you also see glimpses in the report of a new kind of thinking that was much closer to a kind of applied version of Freud's ideas. And here, it was much more to do with the unconscious and the idea of clashing psychic agencies operating in the mind in a complex intrapsychic drama. The case study, when eventually published in 1947, was seen to serve as a political warning for future generations. To study such men, we are told in the preface to the casebook on Rudolf Hess, is important since the action of a small cabal can unleash catastrophic consequences. Now, I don't have time here to sketch out in any detail the clinical encounters that occurred between the patient and the doctors, most notably perhaps with the aforementioned Dr. Henry Dix, an army officer and psychiatrist who was trilingual, German, Russian, and English for interesting reasons in his history. But he came to be assigned to Hess. He also worked as a therapist at the renowned Tavistock Clinic in London. And he and a number of his colleagues got busy in exploring, first of all, Hess's claims of amnesia, which were notorious. He claimed he could remember nothing about what had happened in the Third Reich, but also his array of bizarre symptoms, grievances, and complaints. And in the process, attempts were made to deploy, as I say, these new concepts of the mind. Something interesting and useful, it seemed, could be learned by analysing Hess. And I think the book I mentioned, this casebook, is an invaluable primary source for my purposes, since it does sort of pull together so many different ideas. The book was edited, by the way, by Dr. John Rawlings Rees, who was the medical director of the Tavistock and an army brigadier, and he became the president of the World Federation for Mental Health in the late 1940s. Now, Hess's years of captivity were marked by endless bulletins about his physical and mental fitness. Hess levelled various charges and accusations about his treatment, complaining that the guards who were looking after him were themselves hypnotised or in a state of magnetism. And he claimed that there was a whole kind of elaborate hypnotic state that all of his guards were in. An attempt was made to study, as it were, his fantasies about his guards, to sort of look at his ideas that he projected onto those who were looking after him. And he was constantly grumbling about being poisoned and hypnotized, magnetized, and so forth. But in many ways, the regime he faced was striking rather for its generosity. And his guards were not slow to point out the vast discrepancy between the treatment that Hess was receiving in Britain and the treatment meted out by the Nazis to their victims. But Hess remained unrepentant. He was suspicious, but he always retained one confidant, one, as it were, one person amongst the retinue of people looking after him was split off and treated as the good person. So he made a sort of absolute distinction. There was always one good person amidst a sea of odious officers whom he believed to be in a state of fascination themselves. He split the world then into absolute good and evil, even in the, as it were, in the jail. And this splitting of those he dealt with into absolute good and evil, and the disavowal of any sense of guilt in himself, and the projection of all badness onto those around him, fitted very well. It resonated with, it was in a way complementary to, the kinds of psychoanalytic ideas that were indeed being developed in this period by Freud's followers, such as Melanie Klein, who had indeed developed a whole psychological theory based on this idea of primitive splitting in earliest infancy into good and bad, and the difficulty in infancy of integrating. Now, in normal development, she thought there was sort of some coming together of these processes. But in this period, people got fascinated by the way Hess became a kind of exemplary of this absolute splitting and very paranoid thinking in which all evil was projected into one group. Notably, of course, in this case, the Jews. There's much to say about the period of his captivity. It all has a slightly surreal quality in which these British army officers, as well as studying Hess closely, occasionally invited him for dinner in the officers' mess. Occasionally he was taken out for country walks and picnics and so forth, which I don't know what Hess made of that. But there was a slightly surreal atmosphere surrounding the case, which was already, I think, anticipated when Hess arrived in Scotland and Churchill was brought news about this unlikely prisoner. It turned out that Churchill, on the evening in question, was at a country house and had just arranged for a screening of a comedy by the Marx Brothers. And Churchill said he refused. He said, Hess or no Hess, I insist on seeing the Marx Brothers comedy first, which he did indeed do before he was briefed about the Hess case. Now, I realise there are many other ways. I'm coming towards the end of my talk, but I just want to sketch. Of course, there are many other ways one could interpret this material from the war and the construction of, as it were, a psychiatric case study of the quintessential Nazi. Seen through the lens not of Freud, but, say, of Michel Foucault, for instance, one might see this as a sequel to the kind of account that Foucault famously developed in his study of the psychiatric construction of the aberrant patient or offender. And it also resonates in many ways with Michel Foucault's interest in how psychiatric figures are required to participate in the as objects of study in their own investigation. The idea of confession, the idea of giving an account of yourself, of telling a story about your life. I mean, one can make the Hess case, and many of these other cases in a way fit that picture that Foucault gives. I mean, I would recommend Foucault's posthumously published lectures called The Abnormal, which is a brilliant history from that point of view about the construction of the psychiatric offender. But that's not primarily my concern here. What I'm focusing on is how Hess came to be monitored, and how to find that he was mad or to conclude that he was sane, as it were, simply for the purposes of Nuremberg, was not seen as enough. There was an attempt, in many ways, I think a quite extraordinary attempt, given the passions and the war, but to, as it were, to try to produce a clinical, dispassionate account of Hess's mind as a kind of, in the pursuit of psychiatric knowledge. Alongside these strands of psychologistic thinking I'm sketching, there were others. For instance, he was subjected to the Rorschach inkblot tests to see how he would free associate to these ambiguous inkblots. He was also at one point given so-called truth drugs to see if this could break his so-called amnesia. In fact, Hess, during the trial at Nuremberg, notoriously suddenly recanted the amnesia and said he could remember everything all along, but no one knew if that was just a further twist of his madness or actually if he was a kind of malingerer. So, but there were these attempts to diagnose and to make sense and to use different methodologies. In which Hess, in many ways, led his interrogators a merry dance. I mean, they didn't get very much out of him. I can tell you a bit more about the truth drug experiment later, but nonetheless, indirectly, in the ways I'm just suggesting, the guards did learn a great deal about him. Exploring his powerful wish to resist any evidence of guilt, any responsibility, and they used a variety of techniques, including ideas about children's play, where Melanie Klein had thought that she could psychoanalyze children, not where they would lie on a couch and free associate, but where she would use their play and drawings as a sort of symbolic indication of unconscious fantasy. And something like this was applied to Hesse, where these psychologists studied his drawings. For instance, he got very busy, just as Hitler did in 1945 as Berlin was falling, but with architectural plans for sort of ideal blueprints for the future. And the psychologists studied these drawings and thought they saw in them evidence of what they called a manic attempt at reparation. But meanwhile, Hesse denied any responsibility. When he was told about the concentration camps, he said, A, it wasn't true, and if it was true, it could only be explained by the Jews having hypnotized the Germans and the concentration camp guards into treating them in these ways. So the disavowal of guilt is very interesting. At the center of much of this work was an interest in Freud's concept of the superego, which again in discussion, if you're interested, we could talk about some more. But what I think is very interesting about these wartime studies is not just that they mobilized these various strands of thinking, but that they more directly sought to use the interview, the interrogation, the clinical session with the prisoner as itself a compass to the mental state of the prisoner. So they weren't just seeking information about someone's background or history or beliefs, but looking in the here and now of the interview itself, at how the prisoner treated the guards, the interrogators, the doctors, as a kind of clue. And this was an applied version of the session. And this technique also went on in the British Army in the denazification project, where some of these psychoanalysts came over from London to Germany and would just sit in a sort of neutral way with applicants for the civil service and see what the applicant made of the interviewer without giving many clues, not interrogating, but just being fairly blank, and seeing how slavishly, how obediently these people would, as it were, simply adopt the new authority. And they thought that in a way that might be a more accurate guide to, as it were, this fascist propensity than simply whether someone was a card-carrying member of the party. They were seeking, as it were, to look at the unconscious attitude to authority, to what Freud had called the superego, this slavish adherence, as a kind of compass. And as I said, the report that was written combines these different techniques in all sorts of different ways. Now, just finally, I want to make a few concluding remarks about this literature. In his excellent History of 20th Century Europe, called Dark Continent, the historian Mark Mazower writes critically of the tendency there has been in the past to explain away fascism after 1945 as, quote, a political pathology by which insane dictators led bewitched, hypnotized populations to their doom. A funeral oration on a culture, Mazower warns, is not tantamount to historical analysis. And he goes on again, quote, the wounds of the continent cannot be dismissed as the work of a few madmen, and its traumas will not be found to lie in the mental condition of Hitler or Stalin. And he goes on to quote the following remark from Hannah Arendt, quote, we can no longer afford to take that which was good in the past and simply call it our heritage. And she warns against discarding the, quote, bad and simply thinking of it as, quote, a dead load which by itself time will bury in oblivion. On the contrary, these bad things in European history have to be understood as mainstream and central. Mazower again, quote, National Socialism in particular fits into the mainstream not only of German, but also of European history, far more comfortably than most people care to admit. Now, I agree with the thrust of that argument, but it seems to me that part of the historical task might be to not simply to, as it were, make that point, but to try historically to reconstruct the many ways in which fascism in the past was understood as a political pathology. In short, I think rather than just a methodological debate now about how we should look at this, we need to think about those discourses which Mazower simply repudiates as wrong-headed. Moreover, it seems to me that both in history writing, as it were, historiography, in social theory, and in psychoanalysis, something of the same insistence came to be made on the need to integrate Nazism into accounts of the mainstream. All of those can be registered in post-war thought in these various different disciplines. States of mind described in the critical literature on Nazism were no longer to be seen as alien, as degenerate, as aberrant, but rather could be understood as potentially a part of all of us and part of all society. The question was how far there were other forces, psychically, socially, and politically, that might modify the destructiveness, the hatred, the sadism that existed within us. And psychoanalysis offered a rich, if controversial, vocabulary, perhaps partly inspired by these convulsions of history, but certainly a vocabulary that could be used to think about that history, namely in terms of projection, denial, evasion, complicity, guilt, splitting, identification, and so on. And these concepts could be used not, as Mazower is suggesting they inevitably were, to explain away the wounds of the continent as the work of a few madmen, but rather to understand and analyse the unconscious fantasies mobilised in the ideology and in the actions of interwar demagogic leaders, but also in their mass followings. Now, clearly, in this very brief account, I've had no time to look at many of the landmarks of that literature. For instance, Wilhelm Reich's book of 1933, The Mass Psychology of Fascism, still less the Walter Langer study, The Mind of Adolf Hitler, or the Adorno study, The Authoritarian Personality. Nonetheless, I hope I've done enough through these brief vignettes to suggest something of the complexity of the thought and work that came to be filtered through psychoanalysis and other related disciplines in the mid-20th century and that crystallised in new visions of political psychopathology. Perhaps in discussion we could consider further how far such work remained a minority pursuit and how far it constituted, eclipsed, subsumed, or simply existed in parallel with other kinds of language of health and illness and well-being and other kinds of language for understanding political evil. And perhaps most pertinently for those of you working in international health today, I'd be very interested to know how far the history I've been sketching today is, as it were, a dead history of the mid-20th century and how far it still has these questions about, as it were, the psychological theory of mind and the interaction of minds with one another may still be useful in the mental health field today. Thank you.
That was totally riveting. There's going to be, I think, quite a number of questions. Before anybody starts, I'm going to hand over to my co-organiser, Dr. Sanjoy Bhattacharya from the Wellcome Centre for the History of Medicine, to help the discussion along. So, Sanjoy, if you don't mind, feel free to take it in your own way.
Thank you, Daniel. Before I throw the floor open for questions, mental hygiene, is this a term that comes up in your research at all? It's a term that's contested post-war.
It is, and I think I think Brock Chisholm was probably inclined to use it on occasion himself. I mean, I think that it's not a sort of concept that was central to psychoanalytic thinking itself, but I didn't have time to talk about, but the kind of a strange variant of so-called psychoanalysis continued to exist in the Third Reich. The cousin of Field Marshal Goering was a doctor, and there was this strange institute in Berlin called the Goering Institute, in which something, a kind of notion of mental hygiene and certain forms of psychotherapy were practiced. And the sort of idea of hygiene, of course, in a way has a more ominous context there. And there's a very interesting book on this called Psychotherapy in the Third Reich, which explores that kind of terrain. Mm.
Thank you. Could you please mention your names before you ask your
question? Can I make a suggestion, because I've been talking a long time. Can we gather a few questions just so that people talk a little bit and then I'll perhaps respond to two or three together rather than otherwise it's immediately batted back to me. I'd just be interested in comments, but I will respond. I'll write them down.
My name is Ned Willard. I did my doctorate at Virginia La Folio du XVIII siècle. I fear you underestimate the influence of politics. And as far as torture goes, we've got Guantanamo. We have the good versus evil in Reagan, in Bush. You're making it too academic. It's a very, very important subject. And as far as the preconditions, there's a book called The Deepening Shadow, written by an Englishman who was in the First World War, Germany. Another book called Insanity Fair, which is a great title, by Douglas Reed, about the Second. So there are preconditions. And I just want to mention another one, the class bias. There was a very pro-fascist group in England. Also, anti-Semitism existed long before the Germans came along.
What makes you think you're contradicting me? I don't disagree with anything you've said so far.
Oh my God, I'll have to find something.
Okay, can we hold that one there? Let's take
all right,
a couple more.
I just
want
to see one last point. The Marquis de Sade was the first to describe the pleasure some people get in inflicting pain visibly on others.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd like to point out, it's very good to meet you face-to-face, Ned. I mean, he's taken some wonderful pictures on behalf of the WHO. I mean, I've heard a lot about your photographs that you've taken around the world about WHO's various projects. Any more questions? One, two, start, please.
I'm trying to focus my question. I think one is about the methodology of history and historian as a scientific investigator. And the second one is the about the interface between mental health and politics. But first come, I mean, good that you mentioned Foucault, and the discourse analysis that you make, you know, comes into evil and good at the time, and it may come even today. And he even withdrew his thesis on mental health illness and psychology, as you may know, and then later wrote the archaeology of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So I fantasize about the historians as the future archaeologists of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, when you go into this era, which is entangled with so many social, psychological, and you know, multifactorial, whatever we don't know, we call it multifactorial things, I think there, if you attach this, as you concluded, this thing to the individual madness, lunacy, evil, demonic, you know, type of features of leaders, then there might be a huge underestimation of the what makes the masses follow them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's there. We really have to find, better tools as both historians, mental health workers, and maybe it requires better work in social psychology.
Mm-hmm.
So for future archaeologists' sake, could you mention your name?
I'm Peter Hannesten, and I'm a classification and terminology in WHO. And the second thing is, of course, when you do this, I don't want to sanitize mental illness, but I mean, we also, you know, somehow, on the other hand in WHO, try to destigmatize mental illness. So if you some sort of label this social ills as mental illness, you always contribute to this type of anything ill, anything bad is bad type of a thing. So let's not use this as a waste garbage bin.
Okay, that's very interesting. I'll respond in a minute. Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah. Yes, hello. My name is Tang Mero. I'm an intern from Germany. I was actually missing a little bit in the focus that also the element of frustration amongst a lot of the key leaders of Nazi Germany. When you just take a look at Hitler, Goering, Goebbels, they were actually always persons who nowadays you would call losers. I mean, Goering was totally obsessed with his element as a good general, as being an ace in flying. And he actually had a very poor career in the German Luftwaffe. When you actually then have a look at Goebbels also, he limped and was excluded from military service in the First World War. And Hitler himself was refused the entry into the Academy of Arts in Vienna and actually lived in a men's home, which is basically a place for socially excluded people at the time being. So I think it's important to stress the fact also, while looking at the upcoming of National Socialism and Fascism, also the dissonance between those, what we call the leaders, of their image they have of themselves and their capacity of leading people, as also an unfulfilled wish, which is not really fulfilled by real life, and which they then project this their own rejection into the evil of society is going in the wrong way. And the next point, which I think is also important to stress, is that National Socialism isn't just also, you can't just see it as an illness which appeared, but you have to look at the long course of history, which dates back from the Napoleonic Wars, when you can see how actually nationalism and fascism evolved in Germany over two centuries from this feeling of defeat from Napoleon, with the necessity of reacting politically towards an overwhelming enemy, the desire of unification and the desire of unity in Germany, which then slowly amounted into the Second Empire and then the defeat in the First World War, and that defeat pushing the desire even further towards fascism. So I think those are two key points which have to be
respected. Shall I just respond to those three comments? I mean, I agree with that. Maybe you missed my preface, because I think I was trying to say at the beginning that any adequate historical analysis of fascism could not possibly be a psychological one alone. Perhaps, you know, the primary things are indeed much longer term. And I think I mentioned, the socioeconomic longer term issues, but also the post-war conjuncture after 1918 that, you know, can't be ignored. So I absolutely take that point. And it seems to me, I do mention again Ian Kershaw's biography of Hitler, because it seems to me absolutely exemplary in a way dealing with the kinds of comments you're making, which is trying, as it were, to struggle with this dilemma of how far, because in a way you're moving us in two different directions. One is towards, in a way, your own psychological take on it, which is about these sort of losers who were dissatisfied, frustrated, who found their fulfillment. So that's a sort of a psychological sketch you're making. On the other hand, you're saying, no, but we must beware of that, because actually, to really make sense of this, we need to look at over the long durée at German history. And both of these points may be right. I mean, maybe it doesn't have to be either or. And I think if people are interested in this, Kershaw, who starts off as a historian who's in a way not at all interested in biography, I mean, he's much more a sort of socioeconomic historian and is interested in structural explanations. But when he writes this biography, he kind of, in a way, ends up also recognizing that there's a psychological component and the role of the individual that can't be discounted either. And I think he manages to methodologically to steer a very good path between these things. And I think, again, just to respond to your point, that I certainly want to see this project I'm doing not as punditry about Hitler's mind, where I'm simply offering some sort of latest take on what do I think Hitler's infantile fantasies were, but much more as an intellectual and cultural historian reconstructing the terms of debate, the discourses that surrounded madness and fascism in that period. And in a way, I wanted to just put, I think it's an open question whether we still find anything insightful or useful in some of those studies. But I don't think that the aim is simply to say that will do on its own, because I think one does have to tease out that the job we have is in a way to try to sort of tease out the kind of terms of debate of the period. And to go back to the first point, I mean, again, I didn't disagree with I didn't know what the conflict there between us was, because I agreed with what you said. And actually, the Marquis de Sade is very interesting in this, because in the Frankfurt School studies that were done in the 30s, where they try, a bit like people in the audience, to sort of think, where do we have to go back to sort of look at this? And, you know, there are all sorts of hypotheses about where you would periodize things from. But the Marquis de Sade features in the Frankfurt School analyses of fascism as inaugurating, you know, I mean, a new, you know, it's a new kind of language and sensibility that to do with the body and exploitation of the body that they see as resonating through subsequent history. Now, that's itself a problematic methodology. So I think I see my task more as trying to map these different languages in the past. But I do think that there's a famous remark by the historian E.P. Thompson in his book, The Making of the English Working Classes, where he talks about rescuing the working classes from what he calls, quote, the condescension of posterity. And I suppose I see my task here as a bit rescuing these psychologists who now tend to just be debunked as naive, reductionist, you know, and really very facile. I see my task as a bit to rescue them from the condescension of posterity, because it's true that at their worst, if you read some of this literature, it does seem incredibly naive and doesn't take full account of these wider factors. But actually, at its best, it's much more sophisticated than subsequent critics might imagine. And I think that's partly because people tend not to read this literature of, you know, the kind of people I'm citing directly. So I think it's just a more complex history than one might, intellectual history. And I think the archaeology of knowledge is a good, you know, a good metaphor to use for this. It's part of trying to reconstruct, to sort of dig out a bit the terms of that knowledge. And I think that after the war, I didn't have time to talk about, but a lot of the work that goes on in Britain on mental states, you know, by psychoanalysts, I'm thinking, for instance, of the famous British psychoanalyst Wilfred Bion, but working with schizophrenic patients, of sort of clinical studies that are done, which Freud never did. Freud never really worked with psychotic patients. But a lot of the thinking was to do with trying to, in a way, look at what was common to people, not sort of, as it were, to split off as a separate category, the mad. It was much, when, for instance, Bion was interested in what he called psychotic parts of the of ordinary personality. In other words, of psychotic processes as not something that just belongs to some sort of stigmatized group. So this literature, you could read it in various different ways. I'm sure Foucault would have had criticisms to make, but in another way, it's actually congruent in many ways with his critique of psychiatry, that they were in a way sharing that view that the psychiatrists were too complacent in just seeing these processes of so-called mental illness as belonging to some category apart.
I'll take two or three more questions. There's a gentleman there, madam, after that.
Yes, my name is Boris Engelson. I don't know who I am, but I don't work here.
You don't know who you are?
There is a piece of modern literature, 20th century literature, which depicts lunatic despotism as the absolute triumph of rationality. And this piece of literature is Caligula by Albert Camus. How does it fit into your bibliography?
The idea that there could be a perfectly rational explanation of all of this, you mean?
No, that's, in fact, those who are irrational are normal people. For instance, if you kill your wife or your husband, you are much more rational than those who don't dare doing it.
Okay, I'll think about that.
One of my undergraduates is psychology. I'm interested in like post-World War II, because a lot of research was done by Nazis, and a lot of the psychological information we have now, particularly neuropsychology, actually comes from the experiments they've done, which were really inhumane. There's a whole bunch of ethical complexities around that, obviously. But I'm interested in how, in the kind of few decades after World War II, how that information was used, or whether it was completely dismissed, or whether it was just such a hot potato they didn't engage. And I was wondering what the kind of discourse around the use of that information was, because I know it didn't really, it wasn't really given its adequate value until a lot later, maybe 1960s or 70s. So.
Thank you.
A couple more. Sir?
Yes, my name is Evan von Zylander. I'm working making pregnancy safer, but I'm interested in this topic because I've been living in Cambodia for 6 years. And I was wondering, my question goes to the relevance of this body of knowledge on, and your study for later. You know, catastrophes, human catastrophes. And I was always, you know, surprised that, you know, the body of knowledge that has been generated during and after Second World War has not been replicated in or around the issue of Cambodia. And the issue about losers, I think, could be equally applied to personalities like Pol Pot. So what's the relevance for today and later? And one remark, don't you think that it is has also a little bit to do with the fact that, and your anecdotes on Hess prison is, I think, the confirmation of that, that it has to do with the fact that the Allies still considered the Germans, despite all abnormalities, as peers, whereas the Khmer Rouge are not being considered as peers. And also maybe the reason that psychoanalysis as a school of thought has been generated in the cultural German-speaking context. And the people, some of the people that you mentioned who did this study came from German cultural backgrounds. So
right. Can I
Web
on
one more question?
Yeah.
Sure.
My name is Jim Webb. I'm an historian from the United States. It seems to me that the material that you're working with is very rich and could be put to a lot of different uses. The question that came up for me was about the political significance of this type of analysis for the Allies. And looking forward in time, if we look at the Mau Mau rebellion in Kenya, this was understood in psychological terms by the British, who thought that Mau-Mau fighters must be psychologically unbalanced. Mm-hmm. And when they were interned, were administered psychotropic drugs to try and bring them out of this state of imbalance. So it seems to me that the political significance of this material looking forward in the post-Second World War II world is really quite large.
Thank you. Can I respond to those? I mean, I think that there's a very interesting set of questions about the application of this thinking in other contexts. And I think that you're right, the point is right, that there was something about it being in the middle of Europe that this was going on that gave this a particular purchase, you know, that and this, see, the same if one goes back to the 19th century, to that earlier literature I sketched around sort of degenerationism. Again, you can find versions of that were applied to empires, to non-European peoples, to Africa, to Asia. The idea of sort of degeneracy. The theory of degeneration was the kind of flip side of evolutionism. There was a theory that just as species could evolve, so they could degenerate and go backwards. Now, that theory was applied in racist ways to non-European peoples, in ways one could now quite easily imagine. But in a way, there was also this other side of the discourse, which was about a pathology that was perceived to exist in the heart of Europe. And that the degeneracy was not just a function of as it were, so-called primitive peoples, but something else in France. I mean, this discourse emerged in France in the 1850s to describe the mentally ill criminals and so forth in French society then, or in post-unification Italy with Lombroso. I mean, this is what they were studying. So again, you have that double sort of, you know, non-European context, but also a specifically European context. I think in terms of, just on the point about, I don't know about Cambodia, but certainly after the war, there were studies done of national character that were, for instance, studies of the Japanese that came out. There's a parallel story to tell about cultural anthropology alongside the story of the psychologists. And people like Margaret Mead, Ruth Benedict, Jeffrey Gora, there was a whole group who also very much got involved in policy during the war and after the war. And Ruth Benedict, for instance, did a study of Japanese national character in which they tried to use, you know, these sort of insights to think about how to change the society after the war. Again, methodologically, one can debate it. But I think going back to your point about what's the modern relevance of this, I mean, there is something extraordinary about the endeavour that was made. I mean, whether or not one agrees with the conclusions, but this, I mean, very serious-minded endeavour to think through deeply what did fascism mean, and to, in a way, mobilise a team, you know, of really to sort of open to all talents, of not just getting into turf disputes between different departments or sub-disciplines, but really to get round a table and to bring people together to think about this. It seems to me that whether or not we want to discard the methodologies, there's something about that endeavour that is kind of interesting and in some ways inspiring. And if one thinks about the sort of dearth of serious, I mean, I suppose most obviously if one thinks of post-war Iraq, you know, the lack of thinking in the American administration about what to do after a military victory. I mean, again, leaving aside the rights and wrongs of the war, but the kind of catastrophic denial of the problem of post-war reconstruction. It's very interesting to revisit this earlier history and the kind of thinking that went on, even as the Second World War was going on, about how to fashion the post-war world. And in which sort of the academics and policymakers and politicians did seem at various points, I mean, really to get together. And of course, many of those international organisations like UNESCO, and probably it'd be interesting to know about the WHO as well and the sort of mental health side of that early mission, but how much it really was trying to open up to new kinds of thinking, but including thinking about these disturbing ideas about mind, I think. Were there other things? Oh, I just wanted to say about, yeah, coming back to your point, wasn't it? There's an excellent book by, I think, Paul Weindling spoke last time here, and he's written a book on, you know, the Nazi doctors, which also has, you know, has. So I think you'd find his book on the Nazi doctors and the Nuremberg medical trials very interesting. And there is, of course, you know, there's a famous disturbing literature on this, Lifton's book, The Nazi Doctors, and so on. But I think there are, for my purposes, what's interesting for this project is not so much sort of neuropsychiatry, but it is the sort of latent psychologistic assumptions that were made both by the Allies in thinking about Nazism, but also to some extent how much this was inscribed within Nazi ideology itself, a theory, you know, that there was a theory of the self, there was a theory of mental hygiene, there was a theory of group psychology. And of course, you know, it's interesting, I think, to try to reconstruct that. Sometimes it was used in clearly very self-serving ways, like by people at the Nuremberg trials, who used this sort of idea of the unconscious and ideas of hypnotic rapport with Hitler as an alibi to seek to get themselves off the hook. You know, I was in a state of, I was sleepwalking through it. You know, Hitler's that famous quote of Hitler's, you know, I acted with the assurance of a sleepwalker. But many people then claimed, you know, disavowed responsibility. I was in a state of hypnosis. And in this casebook published in 1947 on Hess, there's a very bizarre thing, which is there's a preface to the book by Rudolf Hess himself. They append this letter in which he says, although he sort of remains a Nazi, he says, I give my permission for this study to be done because it's very instructive for future generations to understand the power of hypnotic rapport and that I was myself in a state of hypnotic fascination. Now, how one thinks about the role of hypnosis, whether one's thinking of it as an alibi or as a 19th century discourse, because there's a whole fascinating literature in the 19th century about hypnosis. I mean, this literature was originally revived in the late 19th century very much in relation to the problem of mass democracy. The word hypnosis was coined in the 1840s to mean, you know, a state of lucid sleep. But it goes, you know, there's a prehistory with animal magnetism back to Mesmer. But by the late 19th century, it's being drawn into theories of crowd psychology by people like Gustave Le Bon, who use contemporary ideas of hysteria and hypnosis to try to understand the phenomena of mass political behaviour in an age, you know, which Le Bon says is the age of the crowd. And that literature is very interesting in its own right. And Freud revisits, when Freud writes his paper called Group Psychology in 1921, he starts with Gustave Le Bon and goes over these late 19th century crowd theorists. But he parts company with them in I won't go into that now, but there's a kind of watershed moment, really, in Freud's version of group psychology and Le Bon's. But simultaneously, one has to recognise that, you know, it's said that Hitler and Mussolini both knew Gustave Le Bon's crowd psychology, either maybe directly, but certainly anecdotally, and drew upon these sorts of crowd psychological theories in, you know, very skillfully in their orchestration of the crowd. So there's also that Nazi use of psychology too, in mobilising for, you know, if one thinks of the Nuremberg rallies and the way they were orchestrated and filmed and choreographed, they knew a thing or two about group psychology.
And Camus?
Rationality. Maybe I was avoiding the avoiding that for fear of.
It was not really a question, so I'm quite happy.
I think the idea, I mean, it is interesting. Of course, there was also an anti-psychiatry literature through the 1960s and 70s. I mean, Foucault being a case in point, but also Ronnie Lang and many anti-psychiatrists who questioned the whole idea that one should treat psychosis as, you know, as mad and sort of say maybe it's the rest of us who are crazy for treating everything as though it's normal and, you know, valorising psychosis and schizophrenia. But I think in terms of the history I'm telling here, you know, there was a debate through the 30s about how far, you know, amongst diplomats about how far you could continue to conduct diplomacy with Hitler. I mean, Chamberlain, you know, going to, you know, there's still a belief that you could sort of conduct negotiations and paper was, you could have a document on paper and it would be worth something. And those sorts of assumptions about rational diplomatic calculation, self-interest, logic, thought, you know, collide increasingly with these other views that come in that you're dealing with a madman. So again, I don't have a solution to that other than to say they're different strands of the thinking of that period, I think.
Any more questions?
Well, just say that Nietzsche had a similar viewpoint, talking about Judeo-Christian morality,
mm-hmm.
And that influenced the development of the Nazi
ideology. Good versus evil, which even goes back to Iran.
Say a bit more about Nietzsche. What were you thinking there particularly?
In terms of saying that if Camus, I'm not aware of Camus saying that, but the normal person is the irrational.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Nietzsche had said that it's irrational or anti-human almost to go according to Judeo-Christian morality, and you should strive for the will to power.
Mm-hmm.
And
but Nietzsche's a really, it would have to be a lecture in its own right, because he's a really fascinating figure for the story I'm telling, because of course, certain aspects of his ideas wrenched out of context were used by the Nazis, but he cuts both ways, because he also offered, a critique of anti-Semitism in that period, and he was extremely, there are moments when you can find Nietzsche sounding anti-Semitic, but you can also find Nietzsche offering a sort of coruscating analysis of anti-Semitism itself, and Richard Wagner's anti-Semitism. So I think where he would fit in this story is complicated. I suppose the sense in which he invites one to think historically about morals, to kind of to question Western morality and Judeo-Christian morality, and to seek to return to a sort of ancient morality that's much harsher, in some ways resonated with some of these more fascist-y ideas of the sort of Superman and so forth. But Nietzsche also, in many ways, anticipates some of Freud's ideas. I mean, the interest in the unconscious, his skepticism about taking people's statements at face value. Freud claimed never to have read Nietzsche, but there's lots in common, I think, between them. And I think you've opened up a really fascinating question, which I should think about some more. Yeah.
Any more questions?
All of this, how can it mitigate or impact or inform the quandary that we're in now with the whole terrorism polarization?
Answers on a postcard. Yeah, how does it resolve? I mean, I don't know. I mean, that must be a very complicated question. But I suppose that thinking about, I think a number of commentators do this, but trying not simply to demonize that quote enemy, but to actually try and understand the thinking, the logic, the ideology, the grievances, to actually make a serious attempt to do that, whether it's at an individual level or a cultural level, seems to me important. And that psychoanalysis as one aspect of an armory of methodologies, it wouldn't do on its own for understanding now any more than it would do on its own for understanding fascism. You need history, economics, you need to think in a multifaceted way. But I think the sort of absolutely knee-jerk demonization of other groups, and the sort of thoughtless discussion, as though there's no rationality. Because the point that the gentleman was making about the, that one might think that even if someone's mad, there can be a rationality. It doesn't place it simply outside of thought. Psychotics can think. They may not think in quite the same way, but just as psychoanalysts were interested, in way that in thinking, the thinking of madness, in ways that 19th century psychiatrists weren't, so we might need to think about fascists or so-called terrorists or whichever group, and to try to understand. And I think the danger always, the squeamishness one has about this, which again goes, I quote Ian Kershaw again, he writes at the beginning of his biography of Hitler that he's wary of writing this very detailed close study of Hitler's mind for fear that it would be taken to be pardoning or exonerating or explaining away the evil that was Hitler and fascism. The sort of idea to explain everything is to forgive everything. So I suppose part of one's squeamishness about this is that it can be seen as a kind of fellow travelling, with it. I don't think it does need to be that. And it seems to me it might be absolutely a crucial thing to have, people from different disciplinary backgrounds really trying to understand something, a phenomenon, rather than simply to set it up in a sort of Manichaean way as a kind of global struggle of good and evil.
We have the room for 5 more minutes. So 3 quick questions, madam, sir, and then sir.
I just wanted to add to the comment. I feel like the field of psychology is a fairly new field. It hasn't been that long since psychology and psychiatry actually split off. But for that reason, there's a lot that we don't know, but there's also a lot that we do know.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the field of forensic psychology, there's a lot that we don't know. So I think that your story is quite interesting, because we obviously have to know about the history to inform our current future. So in regards to the terrorist, a lot of, obviously psychoanalysis, it's not fairly used today. The majority of practice is cognitive behavioral therapy, and there's that push for evidence-based practices.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still, I feel like it could inform, possibly. But for me, what I wanted to, what I would hope to hear, I would be really interested in knowing, would be how maybe incorporating the history of psychopathology into your story. I think that would be really, really interesting.
Do you mean the history of ideas about psychopathology?
Right, models of psychopathology, mm-hmm. how illnesses
yes.
are, during that time, how illnesses, how mental illness was construed,
yep.
how whether it followed the Krepelinian model of mental
mm-hmm.
illness or
mm-hmm.
others. So
yes.
I think it would be really interesting to
well, I just what I was just trying to hint at is that there would be, that when you study this literature, there are different strands of thought. They're certainly not all Freudian by any means, and there are these different, you know, strands of psychiatry and psychology that coexist in that period, and one could debate which was the more dominant model in the 1940s, and I think you might have a different story to tell about Britain and America in the post-war period, because psychoanalysis became, at one point in post-war America, very central in a way, you know, both in popular culture, but also as a kind of, you know, a medico-psychiatric specialism in ways that I think was never quite so much the case in Britain. But it does seem to me your point about not knowing is also important, that there's such pressure on us to claim to know, that one, and of course psychoanalysis as alongside psychiatry could be used in a sort of omnipotent, omniscient way, which is clearly absurd, to claim this is a key to all mythologies, that now we can understand everything. But there is another way to think about this history, which is that Freud and Freud's work and that of his followers might actually invite one to be more humble about acknowledging how little we know about other people's minds and how difficult it is to actually know what's going on inside someone. So that although it could be used in the one way, it also might lead historians to actually be more cautious. Because you see, historians who often claim to not be sympathetic to psychoanalysis often end up deploying a very simplistic, sort of quasi-behavioristic psychology to explain people's motives in the past. You know, that people simply pursued power, or they were interested in this, or they were interested in sex, or they were interested in money, or but without actually, and claiming that that's an adequate characterization of someone else's mind. Well, if you read sort of this literature, it might invite you not to just substitute it with some other equally spurious grand claim, but to think actually we must be cautious about assuming to know without a lot of evidence what it is that actually is governing someone's motivation, rather than their stated intentions. And it's that gap between, as it were, unwitting motives and conscious intentions that's the really interesting one, and we often don't know.
Quickly, please.
Goes and trying to erase the frontier between good and bad also in the thought of also fascism without trying to understand where that thought actually came from. I mean, I think it's important to note here also that Hegel was actually the person who started to launch that discussion with actually the righteousness of power,
mm-hmm.
saying the idea of power basically justifies all means. When you see that that is actually a big jump and also leap in Western thought coming from the deontological approach from Kant and then moving towards Nietzsche, that also has to be understood in fascism, mm. that also when people now judge on fascism and the moral righteousness, just to understand that a lot of those acts which were committed were actually not seen as necessary to be judged because a lot of the people who were actually committing those atrocities thought that they were committing them in the intent of just power and in the intent of saving something bigger, as it was the German Reich, and which the individual
mm.
had no place to be.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Sir?
My name is Somnath Chatterjee. I happen to be a psychiatrist, by the way. But, I mean, my question is, you know, I mean, as a follow-up to your last statement, and that is, you know, how much of, I mean, you talk about serious historiography, right? And there's also, you know, a temptation to sort of, you know, to go to the exotic at this
mm-hmm.
point of time, right? To, I mean, whether it's Hitler, whether it's Paul, whoever you pick,
mm-hmm.
you know, or Saddam, or, you know, George Bush, for that matter. You know, there are books about all of them, talking about their mental health and their sort of psychiatric diagnosis, so to speak. So what I'm trying to understand is, you know, as a process of trying to understand the psychology of events like this, historically, can you detect common trends which help us identify what, because it's always easy to make something exotic and to say it is rooted in that culture and so it can't be transplanted somewhere else. But to my mind, that would be a failure of history. If we fail to learn, how can we transpose these things over time and over settings to identify these common themes? So do you see these common trends, themes in your study of sort of the psychology of events like this?
Okay, so let me take both of those comments. I mean, I'm not sure I fully understood the point about Hegel and Nietzsche, but I agree there's a, you know... I thought your first point was it may be risky to do away with the categories of good and evil and take Nietzsche out of context, and we might need to hold on to these. That seemed to be the first point, is that we might be sort of in danger of sort of losing crucial moral concepts in understanding fascism. Well, I certainly agree with that. You know, if there would be a danger of normalizing this, that, and maybe we need, you know, one can debate the intellectual merits of using the concept of evil in history, but it's I think hard to avoid it. I mean, it's interesting reading history books. You know, historians are usually reluctant, squeamish about sort of moral judgments, but it's, if you just go to Google and you type in, or the British Library catalogue, and you type in Third Reich and evil, it's extraordinary how often historians end up needing to put evil on the cover of a book about the Third Reich, as though to signal their distance from as it were, the pathology in question. As to there being a long sort of genealogy of ideas in German thought about the state and about power that then get taken up again in the 20th century in appalling ways, yes, you know, that's true. But although one would again need to tease out what's, you know, that Hegel isn't simply some proto-fascist, but there's a different context there. But, you know, you've raised a whole complicated can of worms with that, you know, which we could talk about for longer. As to the point about the exotic, do you want to elaborate?
I just want to disqualify a bit of that question. That is also, you know, I mean, given that the boundaries between sort of what is good, mad, and sad are sort of shifting sands, right? I mean, these are things that change over time. So, which is what brings me back to my question, that is there really something we can learn, you know, from history over time, given that these boundaries are actually shifting?
Well, I think one can at all sorts of levels. I mean, I think sort of studying the past is crucial to understanding the present, both individually and collectively, that otherwise one lives in a sort of mad vacuum if one thinks there is no history of experience, of events, and so forth. But I think there's another sense in which I would make a claim for this earlier literature, that I do actually think that it's not just, for me, a primary source I'm studying in the past, but I do actually happen to believe that Freud and Melanie Klein do have ideas that do indeed have resonance and purchase on thinking about group processes now. So I would say, you know, that in response to you, I would say indeed, I would urge people to actually read the original texts. You know, and I've mentioned Freud's essay on group psychology. I don't just think people would find that as a sort of dead and buried, sort of fusty old document. It's an extremely interesting one that breaks down the division between group psychology and individual psychology by really thinking about the extent to which our subjectivity is already constituted out of emotional ties with others in the first place. So Freud rejects Le Bon's distinction between the individual and the group by thinking about how our sense of self is already constituted, you know, internally in relation to others from the beginning. So he undercuts a fundamental distinction that had governed psychology up to that point, as well as offering many other fascinating insights. And I do think the ideas of, for instance, Melanie Klein, who I've mentioned here, I mean, I just would say people should read it and make of it what you will. But it seems to me that many of the concepts that came out of psychoanalytic thinking in the interwar period and the post-war period are very, you know, indispensable in trying to understand trauma, in trying to understand the kind of forces behind these social processes, intergenerational haunting, identification with the aggressor, the paranoid schizoid position, you know, the kinds of thinking that emerged, which again, there's so much more to say about the problems surrounding those terms, but it seems to me that if one has a language either of subjectivity or politics now that is ignorant of those, it's likely to be a very impoverished version of the self or the social. So it seems to me struggling with that history, thinking about it, you know, thinking about are there concepts that we can junk, that are outdated, do we need them? You know, it seems to me is a necessary struggle. I don't see it just as some ancient history.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd be delighted to buy anyone who wants to continue this discussion informally outside a cup of coffee. And so thank you, Daniel.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.